Welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure. My name is Vlad Ben, Policy and Research Manager at GIIA. Today, we'll be talking about climate finance. So from renewable energy projects to sustainable infrastructure development, the green transition is going to cost a lot of money. But where does this capital come from and how is it being deployed to address the monumental challenges posed by climate change? Today, Earth Day 2024, we sit down with experts from GIIA member CMS to uncover the strategies, successes and stumbling blocks in climate finance. Together, we'll explore how private investors are aligning their portfolios with environmental objectives, driving innovations and catalyzing positive change. Whether you're a seasoned investor, a sustainability enthusiast, or simply curious about the intersection of finance and environmental stewardship, tune in to understand the critical role of private capital in funding the green transition. We'd like to welcome our guests. Anna, Francis, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourselves?
Hi, Vlad. Anna Radnev. I'm a partner at the International Finance Group of CMS, working across Central and Eastern Europe, and currently based in Bucharest.
Hi, Vlad. Thanks for having us. So my name's Francis Beechner. I'm in the project finance team based out of London with CMS. Previously, I've worked in London, Frankfurt and Singapore across a range of different asset classes related to climate finance.
Thanks very much, both. For those of us unfamiliar with the topic, climate finance refers to the flow of funds for two projects and initiatives aimed at mitigating and adapting to climate change, crucial for achieving our climate goals outlined in agreements such as the Paris Agreement, as it enables the transition to a low carbon, climate resilient future. Now, I think it would be very interesting to understand the types of projects that are being worked on out there. Anna, how are you seeing climate finance being used?
Well, the region I work in, Central and Eastern Europe, Southern Eastern Europe, I think it's very well positioned to benefit from climate finance. So there's a lot of need for development infrastructure. There is currently a lot of focus on renewable energy, increasing capacity for renewable energy, but more remains to be done. We see an increased use of green loans. For example, real estate sector, a lot of refinancing, sort of older vintage buildings being refinanced and sort of upgraded to be green buildings and financed through green loans. We also see an increased use of sustainability-linked loans and green bonds, of course, with some of the larger private issuers, but also a lot of financial institutions from the region issuing green bonds. And then funds are redeployed on smaller projects. There is definitely an increased awareness across, I would say, the jurisdictions. Financial institutions are doing a lot of education to try and, and get more issuance of green instruments. And there I use that, sort of in a wider sense, but also, sustainability-linked loans as well.
And just to add to that, Anna, I think so definitely we've seen a lot of maturity with respect to renewable energy projects in terms of, say, you've got the huge offshore wind farms that are off the coast of the UK. You have bigger and bigger onshore wind farms springing up around the world, similarly with solar as well. But then increasingly, there's been a huge excitement and initial investment in more fledgling technologies as well. So the likes of hydrogen fuel production and then carbon capture and storage. To some extent, you've also seen a certain amount of funds flow into asset classes like carbon offset type projects. So these would be typically in the reforestation or afforestation space as well, although there's many different challenges around that.
Thanks, Francis. And what role does the private sector play in these projects?
Well, the public sector cannot finance the energy transition exclusively. So the private sector, I would say, is paramount. There is obviously a continuous interplay. I said you need the public sector to drive the strategy, to perhaps identify areas, as Francis was saying earlier, where technology, it's still at the beginning. There is not a proven track. Therefore, you know, there is need for subsidies or public contributions. But other than that, I think the load is borne mostly by the private sector, and that's the expectation to drive, you know, one on the financing side, and obviously investors to develop the relevant asset classes.
And just adding to that, Anna, I think so. If you think about how an energy or an infrastructure type project needs to develop, or the infrastructure industry in general, it's hugely complicated. It's capital intensive. It's high risk. And so within that, you have a number of different players, all of whom have different risk appetites. And in many ways, you see them working together very, very well. I think the government is there. The use of, say, subsidies is really, really important. It was especially important in early stage offshore wind development in the UK as a really good example. But even now, the government is selling £800 million worth of offshore wind contracts in the UK. And the private sector is then going to be stepping in to sort of develop these projects and cause gigawatts, many gigawatts worth of clean energy to be developed off the back of that. I think additionally, you have the role of, say, players like multilateral organizations. So these would be, say, the World Bank or the different development banks that you see in Europe, whether that's the likes of DEG is a very good example, I think. And these have slightly different mandates to a purely private institution, which means that they are able to invest in perhaps higher risk initial stage projects, which then allow for the private sector to step in once they are at a higher level of maturity. And so, you know, the government institutions, multilateral institutions play a role at that early stage development, and then the private sector can come in to really scale up and help develop that industry to become a £1 billion industry or multi-billion pound industry.
Indeed. And you see this in, as I said, in Central and Eastern Europe, in Southern Eastern Europe a lot. I mean, initially, all of the, let's say, renewable energy development and finance was based almost exclusively on subsidies, was not seen as bankable. And now we see that moving on, there is probably no subsidies. Francis was talking about the auction in the UK, for example, in jurisdictions like Serbia, Romania, Poland. We've already started seeing CFD auctions and being implemented. So indeed, as I said, the public sector is driving through strategy, and then private sector will scale up.
Thank you both. And, you know, we often talk about investment in infrastructure providing a double benefit to society, you know, creating services that we rely on and creating that stable income for those in retirement. So when we talk about these projects, who are the ultimate beneficiaries of these types of projects and this type of climate financing?
I want to answer with a, you know, sounds a philosophical answer, but the truth is that ultimately we all are beneficiaries or will be beneficiaries of all this project. It's ultimately financing of strategies and projects that should lead, you know, to the change everybody's seeking and all the international accords are looking to seek. And infrastructure projects do have a massive effect on societies. And again, you see that in jurisdictions where some of these larger projects are new, and you immediately see the social effect. And it's really, all of these projects are now implemented in addition to their, let's say, their actual focus on a particular project. They do look at all of the social and environmental implications of the implementation of that particular project. So I think the effects are sooner felt, let's say, on the immediate beneficiary, but ultimately I think we all are.
And yeah, so definitely I agree, Anna. Although it is philosophical, as you say, I think we all are the ultimate beneficiaries of these types of projects. But I think if you think in terms of what an infrastructure project is infrastructure because it's fundamental to the functioning of society. And without it, you really can't have a modern economy. I remember one partner telling me that governments will spend all the money they can on road development because they just make their money back in taxes, because shops spring up, business flourishes, schools are more easily accessible, and so on. And so it makes complete financial sense for governments to do that, because it has such a ripple effect just by building one road in terms of the wider economy and the wider society and prosperity. And I think looking at, say, climate projects, it's exactly the same point. So when you come to think of, say, projects which are aiming to reduce flooding, if you think about the disastrous impacts that flooding has on society, if you can prevent flooding, that's going to have a massive impact for generations to come. And it's so if you say have flooding is going to mean that children are out of school, people are made homeless, people lose their assets that they have in terms of if all of their money is in their home, insurance premiums go up massively, or the certain areas of the world become actually uninsurable. So all of those factors, just by reducing the risk of flooding by 10-20% or as much as you can, is going to have a huge impact for future prosperity and future generations.
Thanks both. And I think it's really critical here to understand the central nature of these types of investments. And I think, well, last year in particular, the US saw the most $1 billion disasters in its history. I was reading the other day as well that green capital fundraising, while being at an all-time high in Europe and has more than doubled since 2019 to something like $380 billion, is actually flatlined and falling slightly in real terms. So, you know, we talk about these challenges and the importance of this kind of investment. You know, what's stopping the delivery of this type of funding? There's obviously a demand and a need to reach our climate ambitions, but something's slowing down. So, you know, what is it?
Well, on one hand, there's the amount of work and resources, I would say, skilled resources in making this financing happening. For example, you know, on sustainability-linked loans, lenders need sustainability teams to put these in place, to structure, to advise the borrowers. The entities looking to get the finance, again, need to sort of educate themselves, understand, you know, that ultimately doing this type of finance is not to get cheaper finance, but to underpin and really implement your sustainability strategy. I think a lot of the reporting is also focused a lot on labels, what you define as bring green capital and how you report through what's green capital. There's legislation looking at that, and perhaps there is less capital labeled as such, but less, you know, does not necessarily mean that there's less projects being financed. I think there is more of a concern of what a label would mean in terms of public scrutiny.
Yeah, and on that, Anna, in terms of talking about, say, the demand and is there capital flowing into this, I was just looking at the recent statistics on where we are in terms of renewable energy in the UK, and now 40% of UK's energy supply comes from clean energy, which is fantastic. And obviously, we have a long way to go, but actually, you know, Bill Gates in his book talks about how if we are able to go from being a carbon intensive society to being a clean one and 100% sustainable, he frames it as that is being the greatest challenge, or that would be the biggest achievement in all of humanity. So one thing to remind ourselves of is that, yes, there are huge barriers and there are issues with the flow of funding into these projects, but it is a huge challenge as well. This is one of the most difficult things that people as a sort of global society have actually tried to do. But then looking at the sort of more specific things that are preventing financing into these areas, I think one point to flag is just the very distinct market forces that have been at play. post-COVID. I mean, COVID itself was hugely disruptive, but then also the Russian invasion of the Ukraine and that leading to huge inflation issues around the world and rising costs in the delivery of goods. All of those factors have produced challenges for the capital intensive industry that is the climate finance industry. And so if you look at the auction process that the UK government released in the past sort of couple of months or whenever it was, that is now looking to be more successful by comparison to the auction process that they released last year for clean energy. And last year, there was essentially no bids for these clean energy contracts. And it was because of the market forces that were at play. So it was just too costly for companies to be making those investments. By comparison to what the auction process that is available now, the government have sort of come away and reflected, and they've now made certain adjustments. So for instance, if companies they receive these government contracts and then the actual market costs of what they incur are higher than the contract they receive from the government, then the government will actually provide an extra set of funding for them to adjust for that. So I think we've had a dip in financing perhaps because of these huge market forces that are at play.
You have an energy shock in Europe caused by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, similar kind of challenges from the supply chain diversifications that we're going through, moving away from China. So would you say that these challenges are regional, or is it a big global issue that we're dealing with here?
I would say it's a global issue, perhaps felt differently in different regions. And I think it's, you know, as you look around the globe, perhaps the immediate priorities of some countries are slightly different. But overall, the issue is global. And I think that's what, in a way, drives the process. Because whilst there's barriers, there's also drivers, right? If you're if you're looking to finance a project somewhere in Eastern Europe, and you do want to have international funders and make it bankable, so you do need to ensure that you do that at the standards expected. And that's how you essentially concern for, as I said, environmental, social, governance rules, supply chain financing. That's driven through. Also, a lot is now done to try and remove barriers through legislation and all this EU legislative effort to the taxonomy that's been around now for a few years, trying to, and that helps across all jurisdictions, part of the EU, to remove barriers, or at least to sort of make it more of a level ground.
So just touching on the point that you mentioned on the EU taxonomy, Anna. So I think one of the things that I've come across when it comes to, say, the international types of regulations, and this is touching on your point, Vlad, that are there global issues or are there local issues? A huge challenge for investors that comes up again and again is actually reconciling the fact that there's a huge amount that they need to understand. And this is capital that is moving across borders, often into multiple jurisdictions, into very distinct countries, perhaps, that investors wouldn't normally be investing in. And so that involves interacting with a huge number of legislative bodies and types of law, but then also trying to understand completely new regulation that is springing up. And so the FCA and the LMA at the minute are sort of advocating to some extent to have some form of clear guidance for investors in terms of how they can accommodate these international types of challenges.
I suppose we talked about the role of regulators and governments in unlocking capital for these kinds of projects. And maybe politics is another challenge that we should be wary of. I mean, we've seen the kind of backlash in the US against the term ESG, which maybe has started to bleed over into Europe as kind of political will runs out for net zero policies. We saw that with the Uxbridge by-election in the UK, which is won on a predominantly less eco-friendly policy about low emission zones. So I want to ask, while policy and politics can have a negative impact, it can also have a positive one. I think, Anna, we've just seen that Azerbaijan has come out and said its central focus for COP29 will be on climate finance. What more do governments need to do to unlock kind of this capital and move the needle on climate financing?
I don't think that governments will go back on their sort of climate change policies. There's probably a difference as to how rapid the, let's say, the changes will be and how much funding or, let's say, state support can be available for those. I think where we saw concerns around ESG is probably also linked to greenwashing risk. There's a lot of activists, stakeholders raising claims. And that's what I was saying earlier, there's perhaps more of a concern of labeling rather than actually doing the projects. And ultimately sort of moving away from, you know, sort of renewable energy won't be a step back. We see that around, I would say, Europe, that's not going to be a thing that's changed. It might be a matter of pacing. And it's interesting, you mentioned Azerbaijan. I think they're hosting COP29 in Baku. And I think what they're talking about, focusing on climate finance, what they want to be is, if you want, a mediator, sort of an enabler of strategies. And what they would like COP29 to achieve is a sort of more concrete roadblocks, which is where I think the future will be, to have a sort of a more concrete roadblocks. Might not be immediate, but I don't think there'll be a complete retrenchment on the issue.
I think other ways that governments would be able to further spur on the investment into climate finance would be perhaps being more innovative in the policies that they're producing. And so, or being sort of applying out of the box type thinking, if that makes sense. So one big issue that got a lot of publicity the past year or so was JP Morgan and BlackRock. They pulled out of the Climate Action 100, and that's essentially a coalition of financial institutions, investment funds, and so on, that are advocating to really aggressively spur on the investment into climate action. Now, JP Morgan and BlackRock actually then pulled out of this because I think there was a certain amount of political pressure and political criticism. But then additionally, they were grappling with the fiduciary duties that they have to their shareholders and to their investors, as against their duty to wider society and the care that they need to have for the environment. And so actually, what Climate Action 100 was doing was putting too much pressure on these institutions, to the point whereby they felt it to be a real risk for their shareholders. So perhaps there might be something in terms of governments actually trying to support financial institutions when they fear that risk. So expanding fiduciary duties, maybe, and making it so that perhaps if you were to receive a lower financial return, but there was a greater benefit to the environment and wider society, that wouldn't then amount to a risk for these financial institutions. And so perhaps there could be regulation in that way. So that would be one idea, one example. But generally, out of the box thinking and looking at the hyper nuances of the energy transition and the challenges would be something that the government would need to do.
I'd say the governments are also doing quite a lot through subsidies, where, you know, we've seen grants and tax incentives through the IRA, the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act as well, and the EU's Net Zero and Industries Act. So with those kind of grants the government's doing, where do you see the future of climate financing? Is it going to be more subsidy-led, or is it going to be more private sector initiative-led, more government-led? Where do you see it?
I would see continuous involvement of private sector. And as far as subsidies, as picking up on what Francis was saying earlier, I think subsidies would be needed primarily where we're talking about new technologies, new projects, where private sector alone, you know, where it's too early stage to be, to sort of to have a project that would stand on itself with private sector involvement. And it might not be a direct subsidy, it might be a government willing to contract, to stand behind a contract, to supplement revenues only in certain cases rather than a full-on subsidy. But where there are sectors where there's been already development, like such as, you know, renewable energy, I suspect it'll be mostly private sector.
I think, again, talking about the subsidies and just using the recent £800 million subsidy auction that's happening in the UK for offshore wind, just taking that as an example. There was I read a Bloomberg NEF article about it, and it was saying about how just this investment is going to have a huge impact in terms of offshore wind development in the UK. But then the immediate thing that Bloomberg flagged was that by 2030, our offshore wind development deployment would need to double in order for us to hit our 2030 targets. So although we have this huge amount of investment going in, and that is excellent, that's fantastic. At the same time, in order to really hit our targets, we need to be even more aggressive. We need to be investing 2-3 times as much. So hopefully what we're going to see as we come out of, as we go into a hopefully lower inflation economy, and the sort of global challenges we've been facing over the past years reduce, hopefully the investment is just going to be greater and greater, and it's going to be even more aggressive going forward.
I think what I'm taking away from this conversation is that, you know, climate financing is incredibly important. There's a huge monumental challenge, as you've outlined. We need to double, triple, quadruple our efforts to get to our 2030 targets. I think I also read somewhere that China is going to be the only country to meet its green hydrogen targets by 2030. So the huge challenge for Western Europe and the Western economies to kind of come up to that sort of level of investment. Well, thank you both for coming onto the podcast. I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for listening to our podcast, Talking Global Infrastructure. You can find us on LinkedIn, Spotify, and Apple Music. We look forward to welcoming you on our next podcast. See you then.